Hello and welcome to Carefully Considered, the podcast about caring, the issues unpaid carers face and how we solve them. I'm Katie, an unpaid carer and the founder of the We Care campaign, grassroots organisation empowering unpaid carers to feel visible and valued.
And I'm Laura, also an unpaid carer, and we're here to inform and hopefully entertain you. Each episode, we'll be talking to an expert, or experts in this case, to get their views and see what we can all do to get the change millions of carers across the UK need. Katie, let's get cracking. How are you? What's been happening in your busy world?
Well, I'm currently looking after six. And you ask, how is this possible, Katie? You know, because I've got my three, mum, mother-in-law and Mark, and I've got next door's guinea pigs.
Ooh.
They're going on holiday, so I have got Brown, Pepper and Lily to be looking after as well. So that's going to be joyous. I quite enjoy looking after those, I must admit. And then in terms of We Care, I've been shooting a lot of B-roll. So that's all the incidental shots that you use to create your reels. So there's lots of me pointing stupidly at blank space on walls. So that's been my week.
You're like a proper celebrity. I love it. A week of B-roll shooting. Shall we get our guests on and start the pod?
That'd be wonderful. As a former geography teacher and having been in my fair share of exam rooms, I'm excited to speak to our guests. John and Sophie Gasson are carers to their disabled son and also entrepreneurs. They are both directors of Exam Screen and co-presenters of the Exam Man podcast, with over 40 years of education experience between them.
This is so inspiring. I don't know how you found the time to speak with us today, Sophie and John, but thank you very much. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. We love what you're doing. So yeah, really pleased to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the basics for everybody. How would you both introduce yourselves to a stranger sitting next to you at a dinner party? Sophie, should we start with you and then we'll go to John?
I mean, it's been a very long time since I've been to a dinner party with strangers. But I would have to say that I would usually say, well, I think that there's going to be quite a lot to say here. So should we have some wine? That's how I'd start. What about you, John?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of, I guess I'd have to introduce myself as the exam man now, seeing as that's my new moniker from our podcast. But yeah, I mean, that sort of suggests that I'm a kind of an expert in the area, but I'm really not. The name the exam man actually comes from the fact that when you work in a school and you run the exams, mostly the kids don't actually know who you are. And so often when I'm walking down the corridor, I'll hear myself described as the exam man. So it actually comes from being, you know, kind of sort of anonymous and low status rather than being an expert. But yeah.
I don't agree. If you don't know what papers are going out, where and when, you know, the whole school comes to a standstill. So, yeah, I fully appreciate what that actually means. That's, yeah, you don't often get into the classroom because you're dealing with so much. So, yeah, that's great to hear.
Thank you, Katie. I appreciate that.
Sophie, do you think you could quickly talk us through your journey to becoming parent carers?
Yeah, of course, of course. So we became parents to our first son 10 years ago tomorrow. It's a big weekend in the Gaston house. So so our son Griff was born 10 years ago. And after a very normal, inverted commas, pregnancy and birth and, you know, first few months. And he reached certain milestones fairly normally. And then he missed a few, but nothing that was raising huge alarm until he was about 18 months old. And then by this point, he'd started to walk. He had quite a lot of vocabulary and he started to lose his language and quite a lot of skills that he had picked up. And between the ages of 2 and 3, that pretty much just disappeared, and he's not actually spoken since. So it was a pretty extreme experience of early parenting, that, and lots of questions, lots of tests to try and work out what was going on. He was finally diagnosed just before he was four with global developmental delay autism with regression. Is his formal diagnosis, and then the proceeding, you know, the following years were involved about finding more about his needs. Things have developed, and where we're at now, he has severe learning disabilities, autism, but also epilepsy as well now. So he has medical condition which has changed things quite significantly. But to tell you about him, really, I'm not just his carer, but I'm also his personal chef. Because Griff is a foodie in the extreme. Your mum, actually, John, talks about the Griff tax. So if we have to go anywhere to stay or to like a restaurant, we have to go to the more expensive version of everything because that's what Griff likes. He's hilarious. So he runs our lives in the best way.
John, can you talk us through a little bit how you got, the help that you needed for Griff, apart from presumably cooking lessons and books and things to become a chef? From an education perspective as well, did sort of your professional background help you at all, or sort of how did you get what you needed?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of in the early years with Griff, obviously, because as Sophie sort of explained, his profile was quite unusual. So the fact that he developed skills and then lost them, it was often hard initially to really understand what he needed. So in terms of actually getting the things that we needed for him, it often kind of in the early part of his life wasn't always clear exactly what would be right for him and that sort of thing. So from that point of view, we did find it difficult at times, didn't we? And we would often receive conflicting advice from people and conflicting advice from experts, you know, all people who knew their field and were obviously well-meaning, but because of his kind of complicated profile, it meant that sometimes the advice we got was conflicting. But I have to say, as he's got older and his needs have become clearer, and we've understood him more, I think we have found it easier, haven't we, to get the support for him that we need.
We know him better, don't we?
We know him much better. He's got some great scaffolding around him. He goes to a great school. We also get personal assistants as well, which means that he's got people that he knows, he's familiar with, and kind of crucially, who really love him as well, you know, who have a great amount of affection for him, which means that we can be really happy and trust in that as well. In terms of like we've both worked in education, so our professional background, I think it does help you to understand the processes that you're going through, and also I think to be realistic about them as well. So to be realistic about the fact that, you know, that it might take time. It might mean that you have to push at times. There might be times where you actually have to hold back so that you can, when you do push, it's more effective and things like that. So, I think knowing a bit about the system did help. But then obviously we'd always been on the other side of it. So now being on the kind of parent side of it is all new, and obviously it's emotionally much more raw as well.
What impact did becoming carers have in your lives, other than having to up your chef skills and on your livelihoods?
In every aspect of our lives, I would say. I think it's pretty tricky, actually, when you have a disabled child, because parenting is obviously, you know, a whole new world that you enter into and changes your life, in many ways as well. So I think it was difficult to understand how becoming a parent, carer and a carer at the same time, and a parent just new to parenthood, is all kind of mixed up in that. But certainly those first few years with Griff were particularly challenging, because we didn't know what was happening with him. And we were living, kind of month to month before we knew what his needs were. So in terms of the impact on our immediate life and livelihood, that was pretty extraordinary in terms of income and career. At that point, I was working freelance in education. I had regular clients I'd worked for for a long time. I was already quite senior in my career in education, so that was helpful because I could take a step back for a couple of years. But in terms of financially, it was difficult. Definitely, we're not where we would be now if you know that we hadn't had that experience. I think one of the things that, you know, it does affect obviously how you live your life socially, you know, emotionally, how you cope with things, but the opportunities that have also been brought into our lives through GRIF, I think are something else. I think we've had to determine and understand what a good life means for GRIF, but also for us, and also for his little brother and the wider family and friends who love him. Because a good life to GRIF isn't necessarily a good life for what you would want for a good life for another child. You know, we've talked about this recently, didn't we, John, about how a child with GRIF's level of needs is unlikely to go through any of the many milestones that we go through towards adulthood. So things like, you know, driving a car, pertinent to us, doing exams, you know, having a first girlfriend or boyfriend. These things are very, very different when you're talking about this area of SEND. And as a result, we've just had to really redefine what that looks like. And we're lucky that the systems and school and everything that he's got in place, they do that for him. They understand what that good life means.
I think as well that, I mean, Sophie talks about restriction, and I mean, I do think that is, you know, it's obviously is a big part of being a carer, is like your life will be restricted in some ways, you know, you can't do all the things that you did before. But I do think there is a kind of strange, there can be a strange benefit to that.
Definitely.
In the, you know, kind of the sort of unlimited scope of you can do anything at this time, do anything that you want to do, is not always conducive to people's happiness. You know, we have a very strong idea now about what we need to do to make sure that he has a good life, what we need to do to make sure that we can enjoy life with him and that his brother can. And sort of having those like constraints actually really enables us to kind of like lean into that and extract the most out of life.
And you get when he's well, when things are going on, he's happy, we have the best time. We really do. Mm. We really have a great time.
And when Griff's happy, it means so much, you know, like when he's really, really enjoying something, it hits you in a way that I don't think it necessarily does with everybody else, you know.
Yeah, no, I really get that, because obviously, you know, my husband's disabled, so that sort of puts certain restrictions on us physically, but when he's having a good time and he's well, that just makes everything worth it. And I've got to say, here I am talking to you and Laura and doing a podcast, and those all things that I would never have done, you know, because I'd still be at the teacher coal face, you know, I'd be worrying about A-levels at the moment, you know, I'd be worrying about the exam results, I'd be going in to get my classroom ready. So yeah, there's swings and roundabouts, aren't there?
Genuinely so inspiring. You have decided, or you started a business, you became parent carers, you have all these things going on, your life changed dramatically. And I don't know how it happened, you're going to have to tell us. Was it like a conversation that sort of got out of hand and you thought, no, I'm going to start a business? Could you tell us about your journey to becoming entrepreneurs, what company you started, and just how it came about? How did you even have the time? I'm baffled, but so curious.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't, we definitely didn't decide to start a business.
No, definitely not.
It didn't work like that. So I think, I mean, I was saying as well just now that I don't think it necessarily, you can't necessarily say that this caused this, and, you know, because we're in this position, this is why we did this. But I do think it's very coincidental that when things were at their hardest, in terms of we were very unclear about what was happening with Griff, you know, where he was losing skills, this was exactly the point at which we were starting to develop this product, which we've developed, which has become our business. So, and I do think, like, if I'm being brutally honest, that to some extent, I started working on it as a kind of distraction.
Yeah.
So everything was quite hard, quite heavy. And I, you know, we kind of hit upon something which, to work on it kind of every day and develop it and that sort of thing was a way of kind of taking your mind elsewhere for a portion of the day, at least, into something completely different, and to something that felt really like productive as well. So shall I explain a little bit about what the product
yes,
is
please.
That we've designed? Yeah. Okay. So, so to a lot of people, it will sound quite boring, but we love it. So basically, if you cast your mind back to sitting exams, you will probably have sat them in like a big exam hall, and there'd be like a tiny little clock up on the wall, and probably an invigilator will have scribbled some information at the front on a whiteboard or something like that, or, you know, on a flip chart that says, you know, this is when the exam starts, this is when it ends. So I have been running exams in a school for quite a long time. And one day I was just stood with one of my invigilators in the hall, and we were sort of looking at this information that was set out, and I was like, I can't read that. And I was like, you know, there's got to be a better way of, you know, candidates are in a really stressful, important moment of their lives. There's got to be a way of just displaying this basic information to them better. So we developed this product called Exam Screen, which is basically, it does what it says on the tin. It just projects all that information onto a screen with a nice, like, big clock, and it's got all the information about the exams, and it's like an invigilation tool as well. So it will calculate all your finish times and your extra time for students who get extra time. And there's a bit more that it does as well. It's a little bit, that's a kind of slightly simplified version of what it does. But it's basically a tool that helps people to set up exams quicker, and also means that the information for candidates is much, much, much clearer. Yeah, so then what I did was I sort of built it with the idea that I wanted to, you know, improve this thing. And so what I did was, once it was like that, I sent it out to some exams officers, some other people who run exams in other schools, and people started using it, and then it just went organically. People just shared it. And so
we've never marketed it.
Never done any marketing. So there's a Facebook group that exists for everybody in the UK who runs exams in secondary schools, and it just got shared in there, and then it just went bang. And we had an amazing moment, which was probably about 6 months after I'd first sent it out, which was like the first big GCSE exam that summer. And it was, I think, a science exam. And we sort of logged on to our Google Analytics and we saw that 600 schools were using it on that morning. And we were just like, wow, that's pretty cool. So from that point, we started to kind of take it a bit more seriously.
And at this point also coincided with, with everything going on with Griff, as John explained. So we were, you know, having so many medical appointments at that time. But it meant that we did have a bit of space in order to really grow with it, if you know what I mean, didn't it? We upped our amount of hours working on it as things started to get easier. It all sort of happened quite organically. Yeah. It was great.
And I think, you know, obviously caring is very stressful, but also there is quite a lot of time where you are kind of just sat, aren't you? You know, you are with someone and you're there and you're tending to their needs. But there are also periods of time where you have to, it's not like all your time is gone. Like, you have time, but you are restricted. You often, like, you know, with Griff, we wouldn't be able to go out to certain places and things like that at that point. It's different, bit different now, but at that point. So there were opportunities as well, weren't there? But I think we also got much better because we were doing the caring at kind of prioritising our time and things like that, and weirdly got more productive almost, didn't we, I think, during that period.
And then it started to, because it gained traction really quickly with schools, we just realised, okay, there's something in this. People want it. And then we realised, right, we need to up it. You know, we want to make a better website. We want to make it, you know, really, really great. So we just started putting more and more time and into it. And, yeah, it helped that obviously we've both worked with schools for so long that we know how the academic year runs and pinch points and how to approach people and how to help people best. So that definitely helped.
I think it's as a working carer, it's one of my favorite topics around how it does have benefits in the workplace. I mean, in terms of, like you were saying, multitasking, prioritization, resilience, empathy, all that type of stuff, even leadership, like sort of, you know, getting stuff done and making it happen.
Yeah.
Do you think you had those skills before, or do you think becoming carers honed those entrepreneurial skills in terms of, I don't know, multitasking or prioritization What do you think? Do you think it being a carer in a way enabled exam scream to sort of come into existence a little bit?
I think so. As we said, it's hard to kind of pick it all apart because you're developing, aren't you, at all times with everything that's going on with your life. But I think so, because it's just so momentous and it did affect every era of our life. I think I personally was always very interested in entrepreneurship. I was really interested when people started things. I've worked a lot in the charity sector in education as well. So I was always interested in people who set up campaigns and charities and businesses. So I think I've always liked that. I didn't particularly think necessarily I'd do it. So it probably was the catalyst to actually thinking part of that, making a good life and be able to have that flexibility and doing something, creating something, building something new became even more appealing, I guess, because of our circumstances.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. It's quite hard to unpick, you know, whether or not those things were there already. They were sort of like latent in you, and then the experience that you had has sort of brought them out, or whether or not the experience is the thing that's actually caused you to have those qualities. I think that's quite hard to figure out. But definitely, I don't think I'd shown any.
No, you had not at all.
Any example really before in my life. I mean, I'm probably being a bit unfair on myself there, but like, definitely, I'd never done anything related to sort of being an entrepreneur or anything like that. You know, that's just not the sort of world that I'd moved in at all. So,
but you were really good at it.
But it was so it was kind of surprising, but in a good way. Definitely. But I do think you do. Whether or not it's there in, you know, it's there already or whatever, I think that definitely the process of being a carer helps you to develop certain skills.
Hone them.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, definitely.
I think one of the things that I certainly think happens when you hear it is that ability to, well, obviously multitask, to keep your kind of emotions in check and not get fixated on things, because you are moving from often, you know, by 7 a.m. you'll have done things that most people can't even imagine if you listed all of the things, the many things you would have done by that point. And then you're going into work and, you know, dealing with maybe what's something we'd have found a lot more stressful, high pressure 5 years ago. And actually, I think that makes you better. I'm certainly braver than I was. I think perspective on everything really means that I'm definitely braver. I just think if something's a good idea, right, come on, let's just do it. Let's just crack on. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it doesn't work.
You've shared your triumphs there. So were there any challenges you'd like to tell us about that spring to mind?
So there's a few, isn't there, over the years?
There's one specific thing in relation, I think, to having a business like ours, which I still don't think I've really resolved properly in my own mind, but it's the challenge of when you get feedback from people about your product and about your business, how much of that you really take to heart and adopt, and how and when you sort of you know, kind of stick to your guns and say, no, I know my product. I know what it's designed to do. We're not going to make those changes that you're suggesting. And also there's the thing I always find of like, okay, so if you know, like 1,000 separate people are using your product and one comes back and says, you know, oh, it'd be really good if it could do this. You're obviously hearing from them a very strong message, but you're not hearing anything from the other 999. And that doesn't mean that they're necessarily dissatisfied or unhappy. So trying to figure out what the right, when it's right to move and change and when it's right to stick to your guns, I think is the thing that I find always the most difficult. We had quite an interesting one, didn't we, where I almost completely destroyed our business because I was sort of not listening to a suggestion from somebody.
One of them, and it comes from a positive in that obviously it started being used, you know, across the country, all types of schools, all settings, you know, and then in upwards of 20 countries quite quickly. And I think, but because it's an annual subscription service that's digital. And we've made it really user-friendly, which takes a lot of work to do that. But to the user, it's incredibly user-friendly and easy to pick up. And you don't need that much involvement with us to get going, right? So you can sometimes forget kind of what's actually happening, can't you, when you're running it, when everything's, because it's working well. And then I was walking our youngest son to school one day in May, a couple of years ago, and it just suddenly hit me and my stomach sort of dropped that morning there was, around 200,000 students will have been sat in an exam, of his exam halls, looking at our product, and they're at one of the most pivotal moments in their lives. And, you know, something just hits you about the responsibility. And that was equally exciting. And also, my God, you know, terrifying. I'm so glad, terrifying. And, you know, I think it was a good moment again, because it helps you recalibrate stuff. But that was definitely a challenge of, oh my gosh, this is so important. And, you know, our priority is making sure every year that exam seasons go really well and smoothly. That's why we started it.
For carers who are looking to start a business, or conversely, who don't feel they can, I guess, what would you say to them? Just, you know, tips if they are looking to start a business, or tips for even just trying to build that good life, but a little bit differently, that you were talking about. I wonder if you have a few quick thoughts on that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's just not to underestimate what you've gained from being a carer.
Okay.
So, you know, to try, and I don't know, it can be very difficult at some points, but to really think about, you know, those things you might have been good at before, but are you really good at them now because of this and other skills you might have gained? And I think that's helpful in so many endeavours, not just starting a business, but if, you know, if you wanted to start a campaign, if you wanted to get fit, you know, applying those skills and experience you've gained as a carer to any endeavour that you're going to take on. I think a good bit of advice is that it doesn't have to be a passion project to start a business. I think we've certainly learned that is that, you know, we definitely obviously have expertise within the sector, and that has certainly helped us. But knowing our market, knowing who needed this, and that there was a requirement, and that we cared about it and thought it was important, was just as important as loving what it is. I think that's kind of key. I think don't let money put you off, because we had very little at that point because of the circumstances we were in. And there was so much you can do without, before you have to pay for anything. We won a couple of competitions where we got funding, and that's how we scaled the website, wasn't it? And that's how it grew, was through that. You know, and then later we obviously had, got an investor involved. So you can do it without that. Don't let that be a barrier, I think is key. To start, it's just getting going and seeing what happens. And I think a really key thing about it is that obviously so many businesses fail. That's the nature of business. But I think what we certainly feel is that failure is really subjective, and success to us. You know, we may be small in terms of revenue, or, you know, we can't launch multiple different products out of exam script. There's limitations to what that is. However, the success to us is that we love it, and it's valuable to the people that use it. And it's enhanced our experience in life, relationships with people, connection, you know. And that's how the podcast came out.
Also confidence as well. I think that when you become a carer, you're put into a lot of situations where, you know, like, for example, I think when Griff was small, at times it would be difficult for us to take him out. Like, we'd feel, and it's not necessarily because people are judging you, but just because you feel like it can be difficult, and you feel like maybe people are looking at you and things like that. And you know, as time's gone on, obviously we don't worry about that so much anymore. But I think one thing about starting the business was it gave us confidence at a time when we really needed confidence. And to do something, to feel like you were building something, does give you that sense of confidence, gives you a sense of purpose as well. You know, that isn't just related to being a carer, you know, because I do think that is an important thing as well, that you need to maintain an identity that is separate from that as well.
This has been such an inspiring chat. Thank you so much for joining us. We could talk to you for hours.
Oh, thank you.
We're running out of time because clearly, I mean, you have many things to run. We've all got many things to run. But I wonder if, speaking of former skills, John and Katie, you could share your best exam invigilating stories. I'm sure you've got some good ones. if we could start with John and then we'll go to Katie before we end the pod.
Okay. My best invigilation story.
You've got
okay.
a few, haven't
well,
you?
I do have, I've been doing it now. I've been running exams for about 12 years now. So I do have a few stories, but I think my favorite one, this is quite early on. So this is someone who's no longer is invigilating. you might understand why. But I actually, when I started working at the school I'm working at, I actually taught a bit as well. So I taught in, they have a small sixth form and I was teaching a bit of A-level. And I had a group of five students who were doing an exam one day. And it was an A-level exam, but it coincided with a big GCSE exam. So it's like GCSE maths or something like that. So what I had limited space in the school. So what I'd done was I put the five of them into a small room with an invigilator. And, you know, and that was just their arrangement for the day. And everything seemed to go fine, you know, no issues or anything like that. I called the papers back, sent them off. And then about 2 weeks later, those five students appeared at my office door and said to me, "So we've been thinking about whether or not we should tell you about this, and we've been sort of debating it, but we think we probably should." And basically, so as they explained it, what had happened was that this was a morning exam as well. This was like a 9 o'clock morning exam. The invigilator had come in, put the papers out, students had sat down, started the exam, and then he'd fallen asleep, and he slept for the entire exam. And only woke up at the end because the students woke him up.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, that really does fall into the, like, you had one job to do kind of thing.
Just be awake. Be awake.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. What do you do?
So, yeah. Well, you do have to, obviously report something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, report it, yeah.
You have to report it to the exam board. I mean, the students were absolutely adamant to me that, you know, like they had been very careful and nothing untoward had happened and that they'd all just got on and sat the exam, you know, kind of thing. But that was definitely, I mean, that's the story that some of my other invigilators now talk about to this day because it's just like, it's absolutely incredible.
Was your coffee not good enough at school?
Yeah, well, we probably should have been fine in the room, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, but yeah, oh, that was, yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So I think mine was... When I started teaching, you know, it was that, oh my goodness, I'm going to be in an exam room and I've got all this responsibility and everything. And then I noticed that, and I have to say, this was the more experienced older male teachers. I could see them just counting under their breath as they were walking up and back down the lines. And I'm sure you know what I'm going to say, John. They were just betting on how many bits of paper that they would be giving out that was extra, or how many Ribena drinks there were, or how many left-handed people there were. You know, and this just went on for hours.
What were the stakes, Katie? Do you know what the stakes were? How big
no,
were they?
I don't, because obviously, you know, being, you know, a newly qualified teacher, I was just like so fresh-faced, and they wouldn't say anything to me, but it took me a while to twig. Yeah,
do you know, it's interesting. I mean, I worked as a TA when I first graduated. So this would be like, you know, kind of 20 years ago. And I worked as a TA for a couple of years and I did invigilation. And I saw exactly those sorts of things as well, Katie. But I do, I do have to say that in the last few years, like invigilation has been really professionalized. So you wouldn't get away with stuff like that anymore. Yeah. Like, it's quite interesting. Like, and we
you
have
can't
to,
have a nap anymore.
You can't have
like
naps. You can't do betting. You can't do any of this stuff. Yeah, it's not like the good old days. But no, it's been really professionalized. We have to train our invigilators. You know, we get checked on the training that we've provided for them and things like that. So it's interesting. It has changed. Yeah. That's funny.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us today. This has been such an inspiring conversation. I'm delighted that you found the time to speak to us. One last question before we go. Where could our listeners find out more information about Exam Screen? Where should they go?
So Exam Screen is examscreen.co.uk. So obviously that as a tool is quite specific to schools. So so not all your listeners will necessarily, but obviously go and have a look, see how it works.
Sign up.
But we also, I think as you mentioned at the start, we run a podcast called The Exam Man, which is about all things exams. So we talk to people working exams. We talk to people more broadly in education as well. So we have a website for the podcast, which is theexamman.com. And we are also on all the major podcasting platforms as well. So if you search for The Exam Man, then you'll find
us. Please do listen to us. That'd be nice.
So we are now fully part of the podcasting community.
Wonderful.
Like you guys.
We'll put the links
It's a good place to be.
Yeah, we'll put the links in the notes so that everybody can go in and check out your website and your podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to everyone for listening. Please rate, follow and subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts.
We'd love to hear from you, whether it's questions, guest suggestions, or anything else. So please email us at wearecarers, that's all one word, @gmail.com.
Until next time.
Until next time.